I would include in the term memory how a memory comes into being, how it is an experiential process, how we are shaped by memory.
How do we remember public events and who determines those memories? Coming up on In Contrast, James Young, author of The Texture of Memory, Holocaust Memorials and Meaning. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio. James Young is the founding director of the Institute for Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, where he is also the distinguished university professor emeritus of English and Judaic and Near Eastern Studies. His books include The Texture of Memory and Writing and Rewriting the Holocaust. He was part of the jury who chose the design for the National September 11 Memorial in New York City. He served as a consultant for the Argentinian government's memorial to the desaparecidos of the dirty war in that country, and for Norway's July 22nd memorial for the mass murders on the island of Utøya in 2011. James Young, welcome to the show. Let me start with a question. How would you define memory?
I would define it as a process and not as a concrete object, the way sometimes we think about monuments and memorials. But I would include in the term memory how a memory comes into being, how it is an experiential process, how we are shaped by memory, how we shape memory according to our needs, our ideals, our religions, our politics. And so I would stress just the dynamic nature of memory. And then I'd like speaking about its individual concrete forms, but even then, always referring to these forms as kind of tips of the iceberg, beneath which there's, you know, often great turmoil, great conflict, great dynamic forces bringing memory into being.
There's a counterpoint, it seems to me, between the act of remembering and the act of forgetting. Maybe if we looked at it from afar, we forget much more than we remember, and we're very selective on what we remember. What is the dynamic between those two? What is chosen to be remembered? Do we choose it voluntarily as individuals, as a society? And do we choose what we forget?
We do. I think memory and forgetting are actually two sides of the same coin. Probably put a little bit more memorably by Marc Auger, which described memory and forgetting a little bit like the line on the beach between the waterline and the sand. There's actually no real line. They kind of bleed into each other. To the extent that we do choose to remember, we also choose to remember over something else, so that built into every remembrance is either a conscious or unconscious blocking of something else. And it's really okay. It's not that, you know, we're choosing deliberately to forget things. In fact, choosing to forget something might even be a way of remembering it.
Interestingly, how so?
Say we're choosing to forget, as this country has, you know, for maybe the last 150 years, slavery as kind of America's original sin. We've chosen culturally and nationally not to remember this original sin, but to remember instead our triumphs, our martyrdoms, our national pride, all the great accomplishments of America. And that's understandable. This is how nations build their cultural heritages, which is great. But in choosing to remember these things over the Middle Passage, some 100 years of slavery in this country, on which this country was actually built, and the reason for which this country fought a civil war, is in fact a very distinct way of remembering. Remembering that we are ashamed of one aspect of how we came into being. So choosing not to remember it is a way of remembering. We have to call attention to this way ourselves. And so there is a way in which, forgetting that slavery was so central to our coming into being, we choose to remember it that way as well.
Do nations change what they remember as generations come and go? It seems to me that the way you're describing it, every new generation that comes to the fore will propose something about the past, something, as you just described it, that has been forgotten, and maybe even denounce the previous generation as not doing enough to see the past in a particular way. What is the tension that exists between one generation and the other in how we remember? How do we build all this in our national consciousness?
You raise a great point. In fact, there are generational changes in memory, and I would suggest that so-called national memories last about as long as the generation that concretized them or commemorated them somehow. This leaves it to every new generation coming to these memories for their own reasons, and sometimes finding that they come to them for their own reasons, selfish reasons. For example, there's a way in which our generation would like to apologize for slavery as if, you know, we have something to do with it, or that we would want to make sure we commemorate it in order to point out how fundamental it was to the building of this country and what an evil it was. But in doing that, we also call attention to the great gulf between ourselves and slave owners. We call attention to the fact that we're not slave owners, that we're better than slave owners. So built into every kind of generation's memory, I think, is a little bit of self-interest, not always completely conscious, but a self-interest that we need to call attention to.
You used the word commemorate, and the next question that I had in mind has to do with something that you've been involved throughout your career, and that is the shaping of memorials and monuments, and sometimes also museums that do the remembering for us. Let me start with the question, what merits a museum or a monument? What are the events that a generation will gather around or a nation will campaign for in order to remember, and which are not?
Traditionally, the national museums and national days of remembrance were really imposed from on high. It was in a government's or regime's interest to remember events or not remember them, or to remember them in a very particular way, whether it was a world war or whether it was a massacre or whether it was a great victory. There's kind of a memorial logic built into governments wanting to sustain themselves with foundational myths and edifices. Every government does it. It's understandable. And, you know, national memory has played a great role in unifying very diverse and even competing constituencies. Mm-hmm. But increasingly, I think, in our age, we are allowing for smaller groups to remember for themselves. And increasingly, we make room for communities to remember, sometimes in spite of government or national traditions, to remember in the face of national traditions in kind of a pattern I've called counter-memory or even counter-monuments, beginning with the government remembrance, official memory, and then countering it with individual memory and private memory, maybe very painful memory, and then allowing for memory to accumulate, including disparate and competing and even conflicting memories in one space. Now, I think of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., amazingly designed by Maya Lin, as a place intended first to give surviving vets a place to remember their fallen. It also gave non-vets a place to remember the war itself. And she wanted to create kind of a formal articulation of the great ambivalence that America felt about remembering the war at all. A place that you would descend into, a place that would not glorify the dead, but to, in a very dignified way, rebury them in the company of those who maybe even fought against the war itself, as many of us did. And in the process, those of us fighting often forgot the veterans' wounds and the sacrifices that they made. So it was a place where, in fact, America could be reunified between the vets, returning vets, the fallen, and those who fought against the war, all finding expression, what Maya Lin called a great wound in the earth, a wound that would never really mend, but a wound that by our visiting would in fact unify us, allow us to move in and move out, to keep memory alive, and to allow space for every generation to come to this memorial and really find its own reasons for coming.
You have talked about the way nations use myth to build themselves and the role of memorials to remember and of smaller groups to offer counter voices in that effort. When I think of the major sites, for instance, in the Washington Mall, that are endowed or are there in order for us to remember in whatever different ways we do, they have to do most of the time with trauma. I wonder if the function of this architectural sites is always connected with pain, with suffering, and if maybe the counter voice would be that happiness is not remembered in the same way, or that nations don't need happiness because we have it all the time.
I even wondered once whether if something is so painful that, you know, we press it or it remains kind of pre-articulate or pre-verbal somehow, can something be so pleasurable that we also can't articulate it? That's an open question. I'm not sure. But it does open this question as to toward what end do we feel this need to articulate our losses? Monuments, memorials, and museums exist solely on the grounds that what they would commemorate is no more. And so it's giving form to that which is gone. And traditionally, even the tombstone has done that. And kind of the mourning process itself is a way, especially when it's, you know, kind of highly constrained by a particular religious tradition, say in Jewish tradition, to commemorate the death of a loved one by sitting Shiva for 7 days, covering over the mirrors in one's house so that you're not preoccupied with yourself, images of yourself, but you're creating space to remember your lost loved one. And then observing 30-day period of Shloshim, where you don't have celebrations, you don't have marriages, you don't have parties, and traditional Jewish men will not shave for those 30 days, all as a way to continue thinking about the lost loved one and opening space in your daily calendar for memory of this lost loved one. And then within the year, about a year after the passing, erecting a tombstone so that you've had a chance both to internalize this loss on the one hand, and then, if you will, to externalize it and create that space in the landscape that then you can visit traditionally once or twice a year. And so that sense of loss is articulated. That void is now actually filled formally in the landscape, and we go on with life having internalized and integrated this loss, and maybe even being inspired by it. And that's kind of where governments come back in for these big national memorials for the soldiers fallen in wars or great national heroes. This is a way to not just to commemorate, but in some ways to celebrate what they meant to us.
And of course, I think that implicit in what you're saying is the fact that these memorials, these museums, these monuments, these tombstones are not so much for the dead, or not only for the dead, but for the living. Maybe this will sound a bit pedestrian, but I am imagining here an extraordinary novel that Hollywood turns into a movie. And there is something that suddenly has been stolen from us, the capacity to imagine that book in whatever individual form each of us wants. And now we have the image of how The Godfather or Alice in Wonderland will be seen in the presence of this actor or that actress. And I wonder if it's the equivalent when we have a monument or a memorial or a museum. These gorgeous structures suddenly do the remembering for us and they kidnap the imagination. Is this something that you see as well?
I do see it that way. I think both yours and my own iconoclasm is showing here. We are quite wary of concretizing something and thereby displacing it in our imaginations. Your analogy of formalizing a novel whose figures and characters we imagine and make our own, once put into a movie, in a way, oh, that's not how I saw it, and so this is no longer my story. And that's quite common. One of the responses to this, I would say, distrust in figurative representation, generally, culturally, but also specifically around memorials, has been the trend toward abstraction, even starting with some World War I memorials, in which the artists and architects would be preoccupied by creating openings in the landscape to be filled with the understanding, memories, and histories and experiences of all those who came to visit these openings in the landscape, as creating room for individual, even competing memories. Whether it's the Battle of the Somme Memorial or Lost of the Somme in Thiepval, France, or Maya Lin's Vietnam Veterans Memorial, or Michael Arad and Peter Walker's design for the 9/11 Memorial in New York City, these are great abstract voids that have been opened up to create room for every generation to come in with their own understanding and memory. I don't think it's just a trend. I think that there was something after World War I which caused whole art movements to question their very capacity for representing something truly and perpetually and universally, and understanding that there is a limit in figurative representation, and that maybe especially figurative representations, you know, the traditional statues of the general on the horse, make themselves obsolete just after about 10 or 20 years when experience with that person is no longer visceral or firsthand. This has been a 20th century phenomenon. A lot of people think World War II and the Holocaust caused it. I would go back to World War I to see this change, this preoccupation with the breach, with the void, with the unrepresentability, whether in psychoanalysis, you know, psychoanalytic thinking, or in art or literature or music. Even atonal music was a little bit trying to get away from the easy representations of emotions. So I think that is where we are, and I share your wariness of the simple, very concrete representation of experience.
You have been throughout your career involved in helping governments or helping, as you call them, smaller groups or particular communities in shaping memorials or monuments or museums with the Argentinian government connected with the desaparecidos and in Norway and, of course, in the 9/11 memorial in New York City. What is the role of a scholar like you in helping others? I can see here you being an American and coming from the experience of being an American and understanding this in a very visceral way, vis-a-vis being invited by a country in South America or like Norway to imagine something that probably is more distant and remote for you. So how do you approach your role?
Well, it's a little ironic. I describe and analyze national memorials and museums around the world and have done it both academically and then I've also made room for my own personal responses, finding that these sites, in fact, necessarily include our personal visceral responses that kind of rang a bell for national memorial processes who wanted to open up their process and in some cases wanted to be told how to do it. And of course, my role is never to tell anybody how to do anything, but to describe how other nations and groups have done it and what they've accomplished and describe processes that I felt didn't succeed so well, not always for the same reason. And in fact, more than anything, I think I'm invited to come sit down, whether it's with the Argentinian government, who was interested in how I looked at how Nazi Germany was being commemorated by a generation of post-war Germans. That is how a government might remember a national shame. And of course, the Argentinian government of Fernando de la Rúa at the time was very interested in remembering the desaparecidos from the dirty wars in the 70s. And so they hoped that my experience in working with Germany in the 80s and 90s on arriving at their national memorial, you know, to the Holocaust might be instructive somehow. So I was glad just to share what I knew and what I thought and how they got there and then let them take what they may away from that. Mostly what I think they took away is that you have to create room for the process and not predetermine the outcome.
After all these years and all these many experiences, is it your impression that different nations remember their past in different ways? Is it your impression instead that there is a commonality in all nations in spite of the differences? How, in facilitating the process of different groups, you learn that people approach memory collectively in very similar ways, in very different ways?
I think every nation actually has its own national aesthetic, political, religious traditions. Some of them are shared. Some European traditions are shared among European countries. Some are not. Israel has very specific civic and religious traditions that shape their memory and draw memorial conclusions for them, just as our country does. I would say the commonality is in the common urge to remember the past, but they do it toward very different ends and for very different reasons. Sometimes they've had no experience remembering as they were trying to do in Norway after the July 22, 2011 attack by a Norwegian white nationalist, anti-immigrant fanatic with a very clear political ideology. They'd never been the victim of a domestic terrorist attack. And so they kind of were flailing about. This was the largest terror attack in Europe since World War II at that point. And what do we do? And how do we nationalize it? He was one of our own. That was the title of Osnabrück Seierstadt's just devastating history of that day. And so they reached out to ask to tell them what to do. And I said, well, I will come and I will sit with you, but I'm not here to tell you what to do, but I'm here to give you company as you arrive at how and why you want to do what you will. The families of the murdered children on Utøya, the little island where the labor youth camp, some 69 kids were killed there, they will have their own reasons for remembering and how they want to do it on that island, and whether to save parts of the island or to get rid of the island as a way to cleanse it somehow. This will be up to the families. Many of the families had already enshrined parts of the island where their children were killed. So you couldn't take those shrines away. And so my job, as it were, was just to hold that space open where we could point these things out. It's not up to you whether or not to destroy the cafe building on Utoya. The parents have already enshrined it, so now it's up to you to deal with that and how we preserve that or not preserve that.
You talked before about making space within space and making space within time. Some of these monuments or memorials or museums are in the very site where that tragedy took place, and some of them are not. I remember when the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C. opened, there was a big debate. Part of it was, why in the mall? Why this is an event that happened many, many miles away. The same thing happens with the Middle Passage. And recently, I myself was involved in a debate in the Spanish-speaking world about how to remember those that have perished crossing the border to the United States. And do you erect a monument in the U.S.-Mexican border, or do you erect one in the mall in order to remember them at the center of who we are? So how do we choose a place, and how do we choose a time to remember?
I think the world is a big place, and there's room for both memorials situated on the so-called sites of destruction or death and those memorials on a kind of a neutral plane where, in fact, the location on a national mall will fill them with meaning. Occasionally in places like Auschwitz, Birkenau in Poland, this was a Nazi concentration camp built by the Germans in Poland, where around 1 million Jews were killed and probably another 100,000 non-Jews, mostly gypsies and Soviet POWs, were killed. The site seems to vibrate with this aura of what happened there. The barbed wire, the barracks, the ruins of the gas chambers. And people are very moved viscerally by these objects. I've called in the past ruins of memory. And they're very, very persuasive as markers. So persuasive that we often tend to conflate the naturalness of their forms with the seeming naturalness of their arguments as to what is being remembered and who did what to whom. And curators famously and notoriously tell stories with objects which kind of naturalize any story they tell. And so the Soviet era in Poland had a very different story to tell, especially at a place like Majdanek, than the post-Soviet era after the Iron Curtain came down. Germany faced a little bit of a parallel situation when it went to build its National Holocaust Memorial, where to put it. And they said, we already have these memorials on the sites of concentration camps. Why are we just putting it plopped down in kind of a no man's land in this big site in the middle of Berlin? And my answer was that, yes, we have these memorials at concentration camps. And they are anchored in the rubble and the ruins of these camps and the memory of what happened there. But sometimes we also have to create memory out of whole cloth. And we're creating memory for our own very contemporary reasons. And we can do that in a neutral place and thereby make very clear that we're remembering toward very particular ends, usually national ends, and not just allowing the ruins of these sites to tell our story for us.
Sometimes it feels, James, as if frequency of terrorist attacks and tragedies is accelerating. Maybe one reaches a certain age and has that impression, but it can be every week, every other week, every month. And so I dare to ask a very unpleasant question. Do we run the risk at any point of having too many memorials, too many monuments or museums, in that the sheer quantity of what we remember neutralizes or negates the very act that we're involved in?
I think we run the risk of having too many terrorist attacks. And I agree, they seem to be accelerating, and it's horrifying. It's very difficult for us to sit on high or even from low and determine what should or shouldn't be commemorated. I think there's kind of an organic upwelling in the need to remember by a particular community. And any community, whether in Paris or in San Bernardino, which feels the need to commemorate its lost community members and loved ones, obviously has a right to do that. How the community absorbs this loss and internalizes it might end up determining on how long these memorials, you know, will last. The great cartoonist for the Forward did a play once in which a town was marked by a memorial to everything that ever happened in every place. Here, so-and-so broke his tooth eating a hot dog. And here, so-and-so was hit by a bus. And here's where somebody broke my heart. Pretty soon, the town was so crowded with memorials, there was no place to live. So the question is, at what point do memorials and memory crowd out and disable life? And so your question, I think, leads to that open question. And to the extent that memory crowds out life, then it's too much. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that it enables life and nourishes life and allows us to go on in the face of death and loss, then it's okay.
I want to ask you, by way of conclusion, if you can talk to me in a more personal level about how you remember losses in your family, your friends, if all this is something that, I mean, obviously you do it as in your career, but what triggered you to do this? And how do you appreciate your own memories? And how do you discriminate? The word might be charged again, but how do you discriminate between what you, James Young, remembers and what you forget?
In the memorable words of my shrink, in one loss, we experience all of our losses. In one loss, any loss, we remember all of our own losses. I don't come from a family with probably any more, fewer losses than normal. Both my parents have passed away, a brother has passed away. How we live with those and the stories we tell that keep us together and moving forward has been a pretty big part of my life, and doing it a little for other people and part of it too. And so my role in some way is to be a little bit of the memorial therapist, whether to families from 9/11 or to families in Norway or even in Israel, guiding soldiers around the National Memorial at Yad Vashem. And understanding that keeping that loss in play as a way not to tamp it down or to stuff it away somehow is really, really important. Being able to talk about it and think about it in a way that we manage and not in a way that allows it to manage us is really, really important. People have asked, well, how can you think about this all the time? And how do you write about it all the time? And you've spent now 35 years since my dissertation writing about Holocaust literature, Holocaust memory, and now the memory of other catastrophic losses. And my answer is always that as long as I can keep these horrible catastrophes at writing arm's length, I manage them. The moment I stop writing and thinking about them, then I better start worrying.
It's been extraordinary to have you in the show. Thank you for coming, James.
Thanks for having me, Ilan.
Memory is a most bizarre endeavor. We go to sleep at night, and in the morning, as if by magic, we wake up remembering our name, where we live, and who we are. We also remember where we come from and what we're scheduled to do that day. Memory connects us to the past, the present, and the future. Yet, although it looks like it, we don't remember alone. Memory is at the heart of our humanity. We remember with others, and we also remember for others. Monuments are structures we erect to remember a notable event or person. Often, those events are connected to tragedies that define us collectively. We choose to designate an architectural site with meaning. We do so because we believe that such an event or person needs to be remembered not only in our mind, but in a particular place, and not only by us today, but by the generations that will come after us. But in what way do these monuments do the remembering for us? Do they force us to remember in a particular way? That is, do they limit our freedom in remembering a person or event in the way we want to? For which events do we erect monuments? And who is in charge of putting together these monuments? Do they force us to remember in a particular way? That is, do they limit our freedom in remembering a person or event in the way we want to? For which events do we erect monuments? And who is in charge of putting together these monuments? All this is to say that memory is actually a battleground in and of itself. Next time on In Contrast.
There are no halos in this thing. Every face that you see throughout those 1,200 pages is based on reality, somebody who really does exist. There's no holiness about any of this because those people were just like you and me.
An Agnostic's Bible, illustrator and printer Barry Moser, next time on In Contrast. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio.